Good afternoon. I'm going to open the House Committee on Environment and Water. If you're looking for the Metolius River, it is next door, being heard in the Land Use Committee. If you were here for any of the bills on our agenda, you're in the right place. We're going to start with an informational meeting, and I'd like to invite Jack Robertson, I believe guest of Representative Gilliam. Representative, do you want to say anything?
Sure. Mr. Chair, thank you for affording us this time. I'm happy to have my friend, Jack Robertson, here. Jack and I met in Senator Hatfield's office eons ago. Jack has been at the Bonneville Power Administration for a number of years and now is pursuing projects that he wants to pursue, one of which is the idea of hydrogen hubs. And we worked on this last session a little bit. I'm pleased that both Representative Bailey and Vice Chair Smith have joined me in a bill that we're going to hear in sustainability about hydrogen hubs, and I wanted him to brief our committee because of the nature of his presentation.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm going to be brief because I know you have a full day ahead of you. Maybe make this in 5 minutes, and then if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them. I started a nonprofit organization called the Northwest Hydrogen Alliance, and the purpose was to start working with cutting-edge scientists in the region to get together and come up with a notion of how we can solve what is the biggest, to me, was the biggest challenge we had in the region, which was how do we crack the hydrogen equation. We sit on one of the great hydrogen-producing machines in the world in the form of the Columbia River. There's as much water and hydrogen in the Columbia River.
Could you make sure to introduce yourself?
Sorry.
Please.
Jack Robertson, Chairman of the Northwest Hydrogen Alliance.
Go ahead. Sorry.
In any event, every spring we have hundreds of thousands of megawatts of non-firm hydropower, now wind power, coming into the region. And we are selling that power at exceptionally low prices because we have too much of it. It's beyond the needs of the region. We sell it out of region. This last spring, we actually paid to give it to people. This is exceptionally important renewable energy, and what we propose to do in simple terms with hydrogen hubs is to capture that renewable energy, that spring-dominated renewable energy, non-firm hydro, and now increasingly wind energy, that actually is so big and so massive it threatens to, this last spring, threatened to overpower the grid. Capture that energy in the form of hydrogen hubs and synthesize the hydrogen out of the water and nitrogen out of the air and store the energy temporarily in what we're calling green anhydrous ammonia, which is the world's densest hydrogen source. It's safe. There's 100 million tons of it moving around the world now for agriculture use all over the world. So there's a big infrastructure to support its movement. We will create the world's first green anhydrous ammonia because it will come from all natural sources. Then we will take that fuel. We will take it into urban areas. We will generate power with it, with machines, generators that will use anhydrous ammonia as a fuel. And the only byproduct we will get from that power generation, which will be renewably sourced and will be delivered on peak when the grid wants it, the only emissions from that will be water vapor and nitrogen. And since the atmosphere is already 80% nitrogen, we will start with water and create hydrogen. We will take nitrogen from the atmosphere. We will use renewable electricity to put it all together. And then we will essentially reshape wind power to the center from a distant location, off-peak, intermittently, into on-peak energy at the center of load with zero pollution. In simple terms, that's what we're doing. We have a group of utilities from around the region that are interested in this. They've already signing up for studies to move rapidly to a final study stage, and we're looking at deploying hydrogen hubs, which we think we can build within 2 years. We can get one built and operating, we think, by the end of 2010. There are a number of folks who are interested in around both states, Oregon and Washington, stimulus monies that potentially could match that, but the utilities are already signing up, we think, and we think we have quite a bit of interest. And I'm happy to be able to keep you abreast of this as you look at the hydrogen hub legislation going forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Robertson. Any questions? And that was about 3 minutes, so well done. Questions about this concept? I think it's a really exciting idea and a promising way to help make our wind resources and our sort of surplus hydro, if you will, usable and help meet our energy needs in a greener, less carbon-intensive way, with significant benefits potentially for ratepayers as well as for the environment. So really appreciate the work that you've done for bringing it to this committee. I Representative Gilliam's request, but also talking to the Committee on Sustainability, and excited to see a possible bill moving forward there. Representative Benz, Bailey? Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So is this the first time this has been done, or is there another project somewhere around the world that we...
No, this would be the first time, to my knowledge. We've Googled the whole thing and looked into it. We believe we've invented the concept of hydrogen hub. In fact, we have a patent right on the technology we're talking about, which we seek to keep in the Northwest region and build a world-class industry around here. So we're conscious of at the Alliance of making it happen here, mostly because we can make it happen here more elegantly than anywhere else because of the Columbia River and the systems behind it.
Thank you.
Any further questions?
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Representative Bailey.
Just a comment, Mr. Chair, that I appreciate you taking the time to hear, and the committee's time to hear Mr. Robertson today. Clearly, we're all looking for renewable energy solutions, and the fact that Oregon is the Saudi Arabia of the renewable energy economy leads us to see this as economic development as well as an environmental issue, and often with new technologies and emerging technologies, it's difficult to make those heard and to investigate them in more depth. So I appreciate you taking the time.
Yeah, glad to do it. A question, how far away is this first hydrogen hub? So when will we be able to see this?
Our plan is... Yeah.
Power.
Our plan is to finish this integrated study. We're going to bring outside engineers, test our theory. We've been working with scientists, as I said, for some time. We think we're right. We want to make sure it's independently tested. That'll be done by this summer, the end of the summer. And then we want to move immediately toward a hydrogen hub prototype. In fact, part of the study design is going to be to build a 10-megawatt size or more than one hydrogen hub prototype, which we think we can have operating within by 2010. So very short throw. This is not a Buck Rogers sometime in the future. Virtually everything I'm talking about in terms of the technology is off the shelf or near off the shelf right now. There are more efficient technologies that might be available in 2 years that would make it more efficient. But right now we can build one, we think, and demonstrate the concept very quickly.
Great. Representative Gilliam.
Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen or myself can explain the Buck Rogers reference to you and Representative Bailey later. But the thing I just like to reiterate is that this is about strengthening what we have. This isn't a new technology that requires new transmission, new infrastructure, and I think it should be very exciting to folks in many parts of our alternative energy community, including wind, or maybe even especially wind, but obviously our hydroelectric. And those of us that have enjoyed the benefits of the hydroelectric system, I think, can jump onto this as a way of extending that and strengthening it when we need it most. That is, when we peak in August. We can flip a switch and turn a hub on and supplement what we already have. So I'm excited about it, and I appreciate you listening.
Great. Well, thank you very much for
being
here.
Thanks very much, Mr. Chairman.
Appreciate it. Close the informational meeting on hydrogen, and let's move to a public hearing on House Bill 2945. And if we could get the list, yeah, thank you. Sue, I expect you're on the list here. Do you want to...
He's on a mission from NASA right now.
So, great. Why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself in whatever order you would like?
Okay. My name is Sue Marshall, Chair Cannon, members of the committee. I'm here today representing the Tualatin Riverkeepers. I first want to thank you very much for scheduling this hearing. We think this is an important issue that hasn't had enough attention drawn to it. The bill came as response to a very serious outbreak of blue-green algae on the Tualatin River this past summer. It affected all of the beneficial uses of the river for about 30 30 miles over an extended period of the summer. We were concerned about the slow response, in some cases no response, and uncoordinated response on the part of various agencies that we felt were have the authority and responsibility to deal with this problem. The bill, we simply wrote up what we thought would have been helpful to have in place for this occurrence. That was simply to be able to test the water for cyanotoxins, to monitor, to provide notification promptly, and to compile broader information about the widespread problem that this is in the state, and that we, since our experience on the Tualatin River, have learned that it's a bigger problem. I'll turn it over to Brian Wegener now, who will talk a little bit about what happened on the Tualatin River.
Thank you, Sue.
Chair Cannon and committee members. Last summer, we
introduce yourself.
I'm Brian Wegener. I'm the Watershed Watch Coordinator for Tualatin River Keepers. Last summer, we went on a canoe trip. We do a lot of canoe trips. But one day, we were on the river, and we saw this mess.
It must have been really short.
Which is blue-green algae of several species, but the one of primary concern is called Anabina. And it just so happened that day, U.S. Geological Survey was on the river sampling water for their work, and they warned us about this because they recognized it right away. And so we sounded the alarm. We alerted the parks districts along the river. We alerted USGS, collected samples, and sent it to Department of Human Services. And a few days later, a health advisory was listed on the Tualatin River for 2 weeks by Department of Human Services. U.S. Geological Survey did an investigation because we kept getting calls. Everybody, I say, well, what caused this? Because we haven't seen an algae outbreak like this on the Tualatin River in since Hag Lake was, the Scoggins Dam went up and increased the flow in the river, and Clean Water Services put their advanced wastewater treatment plants into effect to clean up the river. So we hadn't seen this in over three decades, at least. And so U.S. Geological Survey did a very intensive investigation and traced the source of this outbreak upstream to a discharge from Wapato Improvement District, which is a drainage district that drains about 1,000 acres of the old Wapato Lake for farming. In December of 07, the dike had broke and filled up the lake, and so they were discharging this water all summer, and it was highly turbid. Which means it had a lot of soil in it, and Tualatin Valley soil has a lot of phosphorus in it, and phosphorus is one of the key ingredients for a blue-green algae outbreak. It also, there were a lot of dead and dying fish we found as we went out there. This is at the canal coming from Wapato Lake to the Tualatin River. So we called every enforcement agent we see we could, including DEQ, ODFW, and Oregon Department of Agriculture, to respond to this. We thought Oregon Department of Agriculture had primary jurisdiction because they enforce the water quality laws for agriculture. And they said, we work with farmers, we don't work with districts. So ODFW, and then we called DEQ, and DEQ said, well, there's dead fish out there, and then it's ODFW's problem. So ODFW did go out there, but we thought it was still a bigger problem, so we called television cameras and sent video to them, and the next day DEQ decided to show up with their mobile lab. Downstream, farmer Andy Dyke, not Andy Dyke, excuse me, Steve Dyke, he farms cauliflower, raspberries, beets, broccoli, and what he had been using irrigation water from Wapato Lake earlier in the season, and he had noticed that the crops that he sprayed with this water had stopped growing. So he called agronomists from Wilco. He called the agriculture extension agent out there, and to see what was stopped the growth on his crops. So the agricultural extension agent eventually contacted Oregon State University's plant pathology department, and Alan Milligan came out, and he said the damage, crop damage is here, it was consistent with microcystin, which is a toxin produced by blue-green algae. And he also did a literature search to find out what the health implications of that, and in our testimony, which we have stacked up here, and Sue will, that's a genius, but which Sue will distribute for us. He found that crops, that recent research over the past 3 years has shown that crops can uptake these toxins and that they would be available to consumers of these crops. So we asked, he collected samples of soil and crops, which he stored in his refrigerator in Corvallis, and we asked DEQ and ODA to test these crops, and they still haven't done that. Dr. Milligan eventually found alternative funding for these tests, which could cost as much as $8,000 if the preliminary tests indicate that they need further testing. But the crops still went to market. Dr. Milligan's also, the test results aren't in yet. He said, I talked to him yesterday, and he said they're likely within a week now that we'll get the test results. But DEQ and ODA still have not stepped up to test this. The other thing, talking with Dr. Milligan, revealed that there's only one health standard for food for toxins produced by blue-green algae, and that's the blue-green algae product that health food stores sell that is produced at Klamath Lake. And there's it's like one part per thousand, and these little capsules can have this microcystin toxin in it. But there are no standards for food crops that would regulate this. Further, the risk to agricultural workers if they inhale the spray from irrigating with water contaminated like this is very serious, and there are no best management practices from Oregon Department of Agriculture. There's no testing procedures for DEQ. Department of Human Services, when they do their testing for their health advisories, they don't test for the presence of the toxins. They just do cell counts to see if the bacteria, the cyanobacteria that produce these toxins, is present. The problem with that is that a lot of times the highest concentration of these toxins is after these cyanobacteria decay and release their toxins. So there may be no more bacteria in the water, cyanobacteria, but the toxins may still be there. So one of the things we discovered that on several levels there are no testing procedures, no best management practices, no procedures or protocols for advisory, particularly for farmers and agricultural workers and consumers, and that's what we're trying to address with this bill.
Thank you very much for your testimony. We'll hold off on questions until we hear from the final member of the panel. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members. Thank you so much for holding this. My name is Jean Edwards. I live in North Plains, Oregon. My husband and I have a blueberry farm. I'm also a fisheries biologist. I was contacted and found out about this problem about June of last summer by Farmer Steve Dyke, who's a fellow blueberry farmer. I'm going to deliver his statement. He's actually too ill today to testify, hopefully not from the cyanotoxins. He's just under the weather. He's about 50 years old. He's been a farmer in Washington County all his life, as is most of his family, and he farms about 600 acres of black raspberries, cauliflower, corn and beets. And he leases ground in the Wapato Lake bed to grow these crops. And as he was describing to you, because of that levee break, that lake bottom last year became the soup of nutrients that created the conditions for this outbreak of blue-green algae. And Steve was the first one to notice the problem. He starts irrigating his caneberries, his raspberries, in mid-May. His farm workers and him saw bright blue water shooting out of their overhead irrigation. He said the smell was so bad that they had to wear masks over their face. And these are all symptomatic of blue-green algae outbreaks, the terrible smell. As a matter of fact, the cities of Hillsborough and downstream all had to do expensive water treatment when the bubble of water went through there during the summer, and they also had an advisory downstream about 2 months later because it took that long for this to spread down. So Steve was the first one to experience this and witness and also to be exposed. He had about 11 workers out there. They were working on their caneberries, and he got skin burns and itching and oozing sores where his hands and arms had been in contact with the water where he has to get in and deal with his irrigation pumps at the wellhead. He told his workers not to touch it, but all of them had some symptoms of breathing difficulty and skin rashes and itching. His didn't clear up. He still has scarring from that, and I contacted the Center for Disease Control over the summer to find out if this is something that they could help with, and they're very interested in this. They sent me a packet of testing materials to go to his doctor. Unfortunately, no agency had taken water samples that had this cyanotoxin in it because the warnings didn't come up till later. Steve didn't know who to call when he saw it. The warnings that were issued by the state over 2 months later downstream for people and animals to stay out of the water because of its toxicity. By the way, it can kill you, and it can cause chronic liver damage as well as immediate rashes and different things. It can also have respiratory effects. And Steve is still experiencing those today. He's got permanent scarring on his upper chest, probably from the inhalation of the spray, as well as some breathing problems. His doctor says it's definitely bacterial, and without the water sample to back it up, he can't put the two and two together. And that's why I'm hopeful that you will add this monitoring requirement to the DEQ. This other sheaf of materials I have here is all my emails to every agency I could think of. I'm a fisheries biologist. I've worked with Health and Human Services, Department of Ag, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, DEQ, EPA, Joint Water Commissions, you name it, including representatives. And no one would claim responsibility for this. And the formal response I got from Department of Ag was they did not have the authority or resources to do this testing. I did talk to people in the DEQ lab. They say they have the capacity to do the testing, but they typically don't do it. As he was saying, they do cell counts. I'm summarizing both Steve's testimony and mine just to save time.
Yeah, we have your written testimony. I want to be sure that we have time as a committee to hear from DEQ. And so if you could just summarize the sort of remaining testimony quickly, and we'll move on.
Steve wanted to let you know that his crops were burned badly by this, as well as his skin, and he estimates he lost about $300,000 in crops. He also thinks this is a moral, ethical, and legal obligation. He did not. He was unable, all of us, including the farm man at Wilco, were unable to get a straight response as to whether these vegetables, the cauliflower and beets, should go to market or not, whether they were safe. He did not get that answer. They did go to market, and he's crossing his fingers. He is extremely outraged that this has happened, and he thinks this is some sort of potential for future food scare contamination problem in Oregon. He doesn't want to see that happen.
Thank you very much for your testimony.
You're welcome.
Let's see if there are questions from the committee for this set of panelists. Seeing none, let's move on. Thank you very much for your work on this issue and for bringing it to the legislature's attention. I don't know whether we have the right fix in our hands, but we're certainly aware of the issue as a result of your work, and look forward to exploring with the agencies what it may take to help prevent this kind of outbreak from occurring.
Right, and if I might, Chair Cannon just mentioned briefly, we understand that for DEQ to do more, it takes more money for them to do that, and they're facing some significant cuts. But that said, we think this is a significant problem that rises to the top, and that we'd be happy to work with the committee, the agencies, and any stakeholders to do more in this particular area.
Great.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. I ask Christine Svetkovich and Gail Shibley, and Tom Wolf, why don't you join them as well with perhaps a somewhat different perspective. But oh, And why don't we hear from our agencies? Go ahead and have a seat. We'll start with Christine and Gail and take questions, and then hear lastly from Tom. Go ahead, Christine.
Good afternoon, Chair Cannon, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Christine Svetkovich with the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality. I'm here today to provide testimony on House Bill 2945 and outline DEQ's work regarding cyanotoxins. As you've heard, cyanobacteria is also known as blue-green algae, and they are found in many different types of ecosystems, including lakes and rivers around Oregon. Under certain conditions, these cyanotoxins can multiply and form blooms, and these blooms can have serious environmental impacts. There's many forms of cyanotoxins, and the results to humans and animals can be significant. As you've heard also, the Department of Human Services issues health advisories for cyanotoxins around the state. One of the public health advisories in 2008 was in the Tualatin River, as you've heard, and there were concerns that the algae bloom was linked to activities in Wapato Lake. DEQ has been involved in ongoing coordination activities related to the algae bloom. Specifically, DEQ has been working with the Department of Agriculture, the Department of Human Services, the local Soil and Water Conservation District, and the Wapato Improvement District. Since then, DEQ has developed a draft Wapato management plan that outlines how the lake water will be managed to minimize any negative water quality impacts. The draft plan should be available for interested stakeholders later this month, and we hope to have it finalized in May. Additionally, there's a lot of work going on statewide to deal with future cyanotoxin blooms. Although DEQ has the expertise to collect and analyze samples, we do not have any dedicated funding to do this work. Federal agencies such as the U.S. Forest Service have traditionally conducted or paid for monitoring of blooms when they are detected. This monitoring is conducted on an ad hoc basis when blooms are observed or complaints are received. Recently, DEQ participated in an interagency cyanobacteria task force meeting that was hosted by the Department of Human Services. The objective was to improve coordination and communication between state agencies for the upcoming cyanotoxin bloom season. In addition, DEQ will be providing an update on this issue to the Environmental Quality Commission next week. In conclusion, DEQ is concerned with the human and environmental impacts from cyanotoxins. House Bill 2945, as drafted, requires DEQ to do work that is not included in our existing budget. We would be glad to work with committee members and bill proponents on any further amendments to this bill. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members, for the record, I'm Gail Shibley, Administrator of the Office of Environmental Public Health in the Department of Human Services Public Health Division. You've got my written testimony there. I won't read every bit of it, but I want to call just a couple points to your attention. First is just the human health impact. The biggest concern that we've got is certainly for children who accidentally swallow large quantities while they're swimming during an active bloom. Algae toxins, when ingested, can cause a variety of symptoms, including diarrhea, nausea, cramps, fainting, numbness, dizziness, tingling, and paralysis. There can be liver damage, neural damage. The most commonly reported health effects due to algae toxins, of course, are dermal skin rashes and skin irritation. Besides the direct impact to public health, we certainly also know that it can impact people's well-being in terms of water treatment costs, decreased recreational opportunities, decreased waterfront enjoyment. I appreciate the Department of Environmental Quality's active partnership and collaboration with us on behalf of the harmful algae bloom surveillance system that we are building with some terrific new funding from the federal government. So thank you for allowing us to go after this federal funding. It's particularly important and very timely. And that's because algae blooms are an emerging global concern for public health, because climate change is predicted to be a potent catalyst for increasing the intensity of frequency of blooms. Climate change can exacerbate blooms by creating warmer water temperatures that favor cyanobacterial growth and by altering rainfall patterns that flush nutrients into water bodies. In 2004, for example, Oregon had an algae bloom in Settle Lake that was traced back to a tropical species of algae that had never been seen before. The tropical species is believed to been seen here before, believed to have expanded its geographical range in other regions as well, including Europe, and may serve as an indicator that Oregon can expect to see more complex harmful algae blooms in the future due to global climate change. In sum, Mr. Chair, we certainly support the intent. We appreciate very much the focus and concern on this issue, and I wanted to flag that additional aspect in terms of climate change. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you. And let's, before we move on, let's see if there are questions for either. Yeah, Representative Boone.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was going to ask the first people, the first panel, why we needed the bill, and was DEQ actually doing anything. So thank you, Christina, for letting us know what you're doing. And thank you, Gail, for ever vigilant in your department.
I guess I wonder whether, I mean, you heard the panel before you and their concern about the fact that they got, in their view, a sort of agency runaround when it came to actually testing these for the presence and figuring out whether the health hazards were there and whether the crops were could be sold, et cetera. Can you speak to that issue? I mean, was there an option that they could have, should have pursued that they did not? Is this something that you're working with federal partners on making clear to folks who may be in this position in the future?
Mr. Chair, members, let me kick it off by saying that first I apologize. I was not able to hear the entire presentation. I was dealing with arsenic in drinking water wells that you'll be hearing about soon. It just passed out of the Senate committee or the committee of the other body. So I missed the benefit of hearing their entire concern. I will share with you that what we have been able to do in the past, we've recently been able to restart both as a result of federal funding. First we had it, then we lost it, or it went away, and now we've got some additional dollars again. And the Harmful Algae Bloom Surveillance Program, as a result, we are pulling together landowners, both public and private agencies. Part of the complexity around this, and without knowing any specifics of this particular case, is who's responsible for the water? You know, I remember Representative Smith, the first day of your committee, talked about how he was bedeviled, I think might have been his word, by in law school on water law. Indeed, you know, we're not a riparian right state, and consequently, who owns that lake and who's responsible for the testing, who has the technical capacity to do the testing, and these being bacterial counts as opposed to viruses or parasites, whatever, the bacterial counts can bounce around depending on the temperature or perhaps the turbidity or, you know, other aspects of the water. Consequently, you put all those together, and it is a bit of a conundrum, particularly when you're dealing with different governments as well. You've got county and federal governments. The bottom line is that as a result of these, the leadership in my office and the surveillance program, we are exactly trying to kind of peel that onion and deal with these issues about exactly who will agree to do what. But I have to say there needs to be some money and resources on the table to be able to do that.
That's good.
Okay. I think that what I'm hoping to find in this issue, and perhaps we can take the conversation up later, is some clarity with respect to, you mentioned the conundrum that we have around responsibility for this kind of testing. It may be the role of the legislature to help provide some clarity, and that's something we may be in a position to do. Perhaps not. Perhaps there's too much federal involvement in this case, and that's we're constrained. But I'm hoping that if we can move forward on this, if not via funding, then at least through some kind of understanding of what the process ought to be for someone who finds himself in the kind of position or is concerned that they may be in the kind of position that our Washington County folks were in last summer. But thanks for your testimony and for your work on the issue. Representative Boone.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I realize that this farmer is my constituent, I believe, or at least in the same family. And I'm wondering where you so eloquently put that statement, who is responsible, and if it's not anybody's responsibility, or, you know, you can't find the person who actually put the algae in it, if that was the case. We had a bill on the floor like that today with the invasive species on boats. I'm concerned about farmers who experience a loss of this magnitude through no fault of their own, and this is a crop that they were planning on taking to market and apparently did. But this is the livelihood of the person, and I think that there should be some sort of recourse or compensation if something like this is allowed to bloom and not addressed. And I know nothing about the time frame of the reporting and how fast it goes. I don't know. I don't know a lot about it. But I think this is something that, you're right, we do need to look into as a legislative body.
Thank you. Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to build on Representative Boone's remarks, I guess the question, maybe you've answered it, is that there isn't sufficient danger to people in consuming these crops that we should immediately do something about this. Are we letting something go by here that we should not? I noticed in reviewing the letter, it appears that you have not found something that is so dangerous that we should put a moratorium on the crops that are sprayed with this type of water. So I'm just going to ask the tough question and say, should we be doing more than we're doing?
Chair Cannon, if it's okay with you, there's a representative from the Department of Agriculture here that would be more appropriate to answer that specific crop question than myself.
Let's
do
that, yeah.
Afternoon, Chair Cannon, members of the committee. My name is Ray Jandel. I'm the administrator for the Natural Resources Division for the Department of Agriculture. We also have a food safety department who would also be involved in this issue. In regarding your question, we have not, up to this point in time, become aware of any impacts to the agricultural crops as a result of this bacteria. As noted, it is a potential issue. Working with the various departments, we'll be ready to be able to respond if necessary. But at this point in time, we have no authority to be able to pursue any actions in this area at this time.
Can you speak to the claim that the farmer was unable to get an answer about whether or not the product was safe? Even without authority, certainly someone should have the ability to provide guidance about the degree to which a food product may be potentially contaminated or not.
I do not know if the farmer approached the agency specifically about his crop until, if he approached specifically about his crop, I know we received some information from other individuals. We are not aware of, again, there's no testing on that product. We do not have any resources or direction from the legislature to be able to test those products that way. So we have we're not able to provide him any information.
Mr. Chair,
go ahead, Gail.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to add, at the risk of diverting attention away from this specific issue, that this kind of concern is something that may sound familiar to Representative Jensen. In the Lower Umatilla Basin, we had a concern about perchlorate in groundwater, and a federal agency came in as a result of some of the work that my agency did and Department of in consultation coordination with both DEQ and ODA. And they were trying to identify, since the perchlorate's in the water, does it get into the watermelon? You would think there's an awful lot of water in watermelon, for example. And my understanding, and I'm raising this only to make the analogy, they did not identify that was a concern. That doesn't answer the specific issue in front, but it's a very important question to ask, and it literally takes a scientific study with approved methodology, et cetera, and it's that kind of science-based, resource-intensive effort that I think may be, an appropriate point of consideration discussion by this body.
Representative Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I just want to know who's responsible for following up on these kinds of food safety concerns. I just want to know which department is responsible. Is it Department of Ag or is it DEQ? Is it who is it? Is it the federal government? And I just would mention one thing. I noted that the crop being brought out of Idaho at one time had I think they're raising squash or pumpkins or something, and that's something that picks up certain types of chemicals that have been long banned. And someone found out about it and got those products out of the local grocery store. I think it was some sort of pesticide.
That's correct.
Yeah. I'm not sure who did that, but just so I can hear it, we all can hear it. Who's responsible for making sure our food grown in this kind of manner is safe?
Chair Cannon, Representative Benz, the Oregon Department of Agriculture does have a food safety program that, working with the federal USDA, is able to deal with situations like that. In that case, it was the one I'm thinking of is onions just recently, and it was a pesticide product, and we were able to enforce under our pesticide program, working through the food safety program as well. So they, we do have a connection there to be able to hopefully address those issues when we become aware of them and are have evidence that there is something that we need to follow up on.
One final question. Actually, it was DDT, and it was in squash, and it was about 10 or 15 years ago.
Okay.
But I've forgotten exactly who it was that picked it up and who it was that got it off the shelf.
Okay.
But thank you.
And Mr. Chair, just as point of clarification, food safety oversight in Oregon is bifurcated. The slice of it that my office is responsible for in Public Health Division of Department of Human Services is for food service facilities, which is basically restaurants, organizational camps, RV camps, et cetera. The growing, processing, manufacturing, et cetera, is Department of Agriculture.
Representative,
it just reminds me of the bill we had before, the water bill, and we were with the gray water. And my concern would be that in a case like this, if perhaps Mr. Dyke, I don't know if he's an organic farmer or not, if this would compromise his certification for being organic and how that's regulated, you know, by testing or whatever. And maybe what we need to do, maybe it's a series of several pieces of agencies we need to actually get together and come up with some sort of oversight of, you know, make sure this doesn't slip between the cracks.
I think it's certainly an issue that is going to take some additional exploration. Let's hear from Mr. Wolf and then see if there are any final questions before we close this public hearing.
Chair Cannon, committee members, my name is Tom Wolf. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Council of Trout Unlimited. I'm just going to make three brief points. First of all, on a personal level, this affected me, even though the water treatment systems in the Tualatin, and I live in Hillsboro, managed to get the toxin out. They didn't affect the taste or the smell. So for a month or longer, the water that came into the drinking water that was available to a lot of people in Hillsboro, A metropolis of 90,000 people, were unable to drink their water just straight out of the tap. The only way you could really do it was either to, even a filter wouldn't really affect the taste. You had to let it sit in the refrigerator for a while and it to get the taste back to semi-normal. I noticed that the stores did a box office record sale of bottled water. In fact, you couldn't get any bottled water in any stores in my area for a long time. So in a time when drinking water supply is very important and when they're in the Tualatin Basin, they're looking at raising the level of Hag Lake by 40 feet, it seems a tragedy that we allow something like this to cause that could have a severe impact, short term maybe, but a severe impact on people drinking water out of this basin and possibly other basins where cyanotoxins might outbreak. Second fisheries. I have no idea how this would affect fish, but like many other algae blooms, it can have a negative impact on macroinvertebrates. It could have possibly a toxic impact on the flesh of the fish and could cause harm to people that eat fish out of the system. I haven't seen any studies on this particular bloom and what it does, but I've seen studies on other similar type of algae blooms, and they can have a negative impact on the fish, on the fishermen, and on the macroinvertebrates. So we have to be concerned about that. Thirdly, this bill, which Trout Unlimited supports, would provide immediate response. One of the problems that was dealt with this current outbreak is to be fairly honest, nobody knew what to do for a while. This bill would help provide language that would allow an immediate response and a response very quickly to deal with the problem, and we need this sort of language so that in future when these sort of things, outbreaks happen with cyanotoxins, we can deal with them quickly and effectively. Thank you.
Thanks very much. Appreciate the panelists and look forward to seeing the fiscals associated with this bill. We'll take it up again at that point if we think there's a chance to bring it on down.
May I make one more comment, please?
You may. Thank briefly, you. Though, we have a lot on our agenda.
I understand. Jean Edwards again, farmer from Washington County. I didn't make a couple of points I wanted to. One, this is not rocket science, and it's not really expensive. The researcher at Oregon State who claims that the cyanotoxin bacteria stay alive as long as the fruit and vegetables are moist and go to market can be a health hazard and cause liver damage. His estimate of testing all these vegetables that farmer Steve Dyke had was $8,000. We don't need to create a new bureaucracy. It's out there. DEQ has the folks to do it, as well as Oregon State. So I'd plead with you, please, what am I going to tell Steve when this happens again next year? We still don't have an answer. Who's going to test this stuff? If it's less than $10,000, can't someone scrape up the money? And that's what I want to let you know today, even on an interim basis, if we can assign some responsibility so we know who to call when this happens, so these fruits and vegetables aren't going to market. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Appreciate you being here. Committee, I'm sort of two minds about this. We will wait to get a fiscal. It's a matter of weighing this, assuming that there's a cost associated with it, with other priorities of the department. And that is something that could happen in Ways and Means. Of course, it would require us to refer this on to Ways and Means and say, look, we think this is important enough that you ought to consider it against the other work of the department. I know that Representative Gilliam would oppose getting rid of any other work of the Department of Environmental Quality, but that would be the choice I think that Ways and Means would face in this kind of budget environment. Representative Boone, did you have a comment?
Yeah, okay. Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just thinking of sometimes the agencies have fines and penalties, and those fees go into a fund that, and actually, it wouldn't have to be that particular project or whatever it is, but the judges in some of these cases will assign the amount of the fine to go to something to repair the problem or a problem, and so it doesn't necessarily always go to the general fund. And in this case, I think you had a watershed council person here. Maybe the watershed council could apply for a grant from one of the agencies or some funding source and for this purpose and create a fund that can be used for this testing and work out some kind of arrangement that way.
I appreciate the comment, Representative Boone. I mean, certainly any like creative funding, is probably, well, certainly would be helpful if we're going to move this kind of concept forward. But like I say, I'd be offline interested in taking the committee's advice about whether this, in their view, rises to the level enough of a priority to merit sending it down to Ways and Means where it could be considered against the other funding priorities of the agency. Thank you very much for the work on this bill. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2945. And here's the plan, committee members. We're going to do work sessions on House Bill 2185 and 3063. We will then move on to do a public hearing on 3369, and we'll finish up with a public hearing on HCR 9. So that's our work in the next hour and 10 minutes. And with that, I will open a work session on House Bill 2185 and ask Christine, I think, no rest. Come on back up. We have members dash two amendments. I think that's right. Dash twos that should be at the dais. And we heard this bill, boy, in January?
February,
early February, perhaps. A while back, committee raised a number of good questions. Our representatives from DEQ have worked with folks to try to address some of those issues. Those people included Representative Benz, Representative, I don't know if you have any comments at this point or want to stay quiet, that'll be fine too.
Well, I will just say the department brought in a number of different solutions, and the one that they've come up with is the best of a difficult lot. And as you know, my feelings about the bill are negative, but not about the portion that has to do with the fee. At least the calculation of the amount.
Great. Thank you for those comments. Will you remind us what this issue is about?
You bet.
For some members, it's been a while since we looked at this
bill. And we know you have a lot to consider. So.
And then talk about what the amendment would do.
You bet. Yes. Thank you, Chair Cannon. Members of the committee, for the record, I'm Nina DeConcini with the Department of Environmental Quality in our Northwest Region Office, which oversees the 401 water quality certification application process. And with me, as you know, is Christine Svekovich, also of DEQ in our water quality division. So the purpose today is to give you an update about the work on DEQ's 401 water quality certification fee bill, which was House Bill 2185 that came before you on February 19, 2009. As Chair Cannon just indicated, we have been working on the bill and have proposed a number of changes outlined in House Bill 2185-2, which is before you. And I'm just going to give a quick overview so you know exactly, you know, what this bill does. Under Section 401 of the Clean Water Act, any federal license or permit to conduct an activity that may cause a discharge to waters of the United States has to receive a water quality certification. House Bill 2185-2 focuses on what's called the in-water projects, also known as removal fill projects, and that's different from the part of the Act that deals with licensing hydroelectric projects or dam projects. Examples that require 401 certifications include wetlands for development and dredging. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers has a number of exemptions for certain types of activities, and those include agriculture, ranching, maintenance of existing structures, and emergency reconstruction of existing structures, such as dikes or dams, that allow those activities to occur without getting a permit or a 401 certification from DEQ. So that's just a quick reminder of what this is all about. So before you, House Bill 2185-2 removes the proposed fee table and the existing exemptions, which include the commercial land, sand, and gravel operations, projects that remove less than 500 cubic yards of material, and projects that fill less than 2 acres of wetlands, or projects that already have to pay a surface mining fee to Dogami. House Bill 2185-2 clarifies that DEQ can revise the fees through rulemaking, although we don't specify a timetable for doing so right now. If the bill passes, we will continue to work. DEQ will continue to work with our stakeholders and our advisory committee after the session concludes to develop a fee table and implementation schedule for the bill. It will hopefully reflect DEQ's need for additional resources for this 401 program while being mindful of the financial impact to the 401 fee-paying applicant, especially those that fall into the lower tier of the fee table. And we certainly are well aware of the economic burden if we were to establish new fees right now, given what's going on with the economy. House Bill 2185-2 also provides sideboards on how the fee schedule should be developed in Section 1, parentheses 2. The amended bill also includes an explicit provision in Section 1, parentheses 3, for applicants to elevate any issues about their concerns about the fees or the manner in which DEQ is processing a particular type of 401 application. And that makes to ensure that the applicant has some ability to elevate those issues up the chain within DEQ. Also of importance today is the anticipation of the federally allocated stimulus funds that Oregon expects to receive, and what DEQ has been doing to work with partners like the Army Corps, the Department of Transportation, local governments. We fully expect that some of these projects are going to require a 401, and the timetable will be very, very short. So we have been looking at all the nooks and crannies around the state within DEQ to figure out if there are additional resources we can bring to bear to make sure that we can turn these projects around in response to the stimulus timetable. We've been keeping our stakeholders and advisory committee members apprised of the developments associated with this bill, including letting them know about this work session today. And we sincerely appreciate the time and the effort and the interest all of you have shown to help us craft something that will still be water quality protective as well as be responsive to the applicants. So thank you.
see if there are questions before we move. Stay at the dais in case we get any as we move into discussion, but
sure.
At this point I would accept a motion on the dash two amendments.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I adopt. It would be nice.
If you could.
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the dash two amendments dated 4609.
Representative Smith moves to adopt the dash two amendments dated 4609. Is there any discussion? Representative Barker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would simply note that I think an approach which allows a department to establish fees in situations like this with appropriate sideboards so that they know what they're working toward is a good idea, as so long as the sideboards are adequate. And I'm wondering whether the criteria for the amount of the fee is adequately contained in this amendment. It might be, but I don't see it.
I think you're right. It's not in here, the level of the fee. Can you speak
right.
to where we would find that and how that's determined?
Yeah, up to you. Go ahead, Christine.
Chair Cannon, Representative Barnhart, for the record, my name is Christine Svetkovich with the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality. In House Bill 2185-2, Section 1, parentheses 2, in line 19, it says that we would have to consider the estimated or actual costs incurred by the Department of Environmental Quality. And so that's the sideboards related to what the size of the fee would be.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that's right. So what we're telling them, if I understand it then, is that the amount of the fee should be determined by what it actually costs
right.
to do the work.
That's the intent.
Thank you.
Yep.
I think that answers my question.
Okay.
Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the folks, to build on Representative Barnhart's remarks, we had a very similar conversation in our last review of this in the work group, and felt that given the various alternatives that we discussed, there weren't many controls or standards except what they actually spent. We put in, of course, the opportunity for someone who was unhappy with the with that which was charged to have it reviewed by the director, and that would take them right back to those very sideboards that Representative Barnhart just called out. So we think, given the nature of the situation, this is probably as good as it would get. This is actually the third or the fourth approach that was taken by the work group, and like I just said, I think this is probably as good as we're going to get. Just so everyone knows, we did try a number of different other approaches first.
Mm-hmm. Any further discussion? Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are we in a kind of little I got a secret game? I don't seem to have anywhere in my possession the amendments that we are adopting.
Oh dear, they should be in your
I
stack.
Went through the pack. Well, I had a different group of those.
I'm going to stand the committee at ease. Oh, Sue, do you have them?
It's a secret game. It is a secret game.
Jefferson took them.
Yeah. Clearly. Yeah, I'm hoarding the amendments.
Always hoarding amendments.
People whose names start with J don't get them.
Yeah,
thank you.
Must be last names only.
Last names only, yes. Okay. Or, if your first name starts with J, you get two.
Right.
Or you break your chair on the way in.
What was that?
I mean, yeah. Too many muffins, Representative. Too many muffins. I really enjoy the muffins.
Is there any further discussion on the dash two amendments?
only Mr.
Representative Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Only that, as I understand it, a vote for the amendments doesn't mean one needs
That's
to
right.
vote for the bills.
That's right.
Thank you.
Seeing none, is there any objection to the dash two amendments? Motion before us. Dash twos are adopted, and take a motion on the bill.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2185 as amendment
as amended, to the floor with a due pass recommendation that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Representative Smith moves House Bill 2185 is amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that it be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Discussion on the bill. Representative Benz.
Mr. Chair, only to say that a number of my constituents have indicated great displeasure at the removal of their former exclusion, and therefore I'll be voting no on the bill. That is the former area that was excluded, is now included, and they are not happy with that.
Thank you, Representative. And I appreciate, despite the misgivings that you felt about the approach that was taken here and the ending of that exemption, your willingness to work with the department on a approach to assessing the fee that I think makes a lot more sense than the bill that we heard originally. So your participation has resulted in a stronger bill. I respect the fact that you are now not able still to support it, but I do appreciate the time that you spent on it. Representative Barnhart.
Thank you. I wonder if Representative Benz would mind being just a tiny bit more explicit so I know what exclusion occurred or didn't occur.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Benz.
Representative Barnhart, the language from line 8 down to line 15, those activities previously did not have a fee, and the department could not charge for those charge when it issued a 401 for those types of modest activities. They, as a result of this new bill, will now be included in those activities for which a fee is charged. And to build on the chair's kind remarks, I had a suspicion this bill might pass, and therefore I thought it was in my constituents' best interest to try to assist on the cost element.
Any further discussion? Will the clerk please call the roll?
Aye.
Representative
Barnhart?
Aye.
Representative
Benz?
No.
Representative Boone?
Aye.
Representative Jensen?
Aye.
Vice Chair Smith?
Aye.
Vice Chair Gilliam?
No.
Chair Kahn?
Aye. Motion carries, and this bill is sent as amended to the Committee on Ways and Means, where Representative Jensen, I expect, will find ourselves taking it up in May.
Probably.
Thank you very much, Chair Kahn, for your work on this.
Committee.
And with that, I'll close the work session on House Bill 2185. And members, draw your attention back to a bill we heard more recently. In fact, it was just last week, House Bill 3063. Open a work session on that bill. Probably oversight on our part that we didn't schedule the work session for the day we heard it, not expecting to take any testimony today. This is a technical change with one piece of substance, and I have now gone through and read this bill, at least read every amended portion of this bill to confirm for myself that there are no changes except the renaming of the Natural Heritage Plan to Oregon Natural Areas Plan, and then the single substantive piece on page 7, line 33, that permits other institutions in the Oregon University system to administer this program. And there are you'll see other larger sections of text, but it's just reconfiguring. There are deletions and then insertions. And in my reading, and based on the testimony we heard last week, there are no other effects of the bill, and there is no known opposition. So I would take a motion on House Bill 3063.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3063 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Smith moves House Bill 3063 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Representative Benz.
Mr. Chair, I was trying to figure out exactly what was going on other than a renaming under this bill, so I went back and looked at the testimony of Mr. Kagan and found that, as I understand it, the hope is that by changing the name from heritage area to natural resource area, the focus will be more direct upon the council's focus on exactly that natural areas. But if I recall correctly,
he was here.
I'm here.
perhaps I could ask him.
Yeah, go ahead and ask a question. Thank you. Glad you're here, Gene.
To the record, it's Jimmy Kagan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for this opportunity. And Mr. Kagan, I think you've robbed me of my chance to misconstrue your former testimony, so I'll have to.
Sorry.
I'm just looking at the last paragraph on what you said, and it says, to determine what impacts a natural resource management activity might be having, managers must have a control site, that is, a study site, to identify which baseline conditions are, natural areas are important, so forth and so on. Do I recall correctly that I asked if this legislation would in any way expand the authority you already have to do that?
Yes.
And what was your answer?
No.
So, Mr. Chair.
This fellow.
Sorry, I didn't see that right either.
So the thought is merely to change the label of what you're already doing, not to expand that authority?
Yes, Representative Benson, Chair. It's just to do that. It's to make it fit better in with the regional activities and so that people can understand what the authority of the bill is.
Thank you.
Great. Any other questions or comments? Motion before us is to pass recommendation into the floor on 3063. If there's no further discussion.
One question.
Oh, Representative Gillian.
Just a quick question, Mr. Chair. The line that you brought us our attention to, not being a lawyer, that doesn't exclude anyone in the system. You wouldn't have to say, and any institutions in the system. It works and other. They're all eligible.
That's certainly my reading of it, and I think that's the intent.
The intent is that INR is a OUS institution, and that all of the OUS institutions should be able to manage pieces of INR.
Yeah, great. So I don't think there's anything limiting about this language. Great. Seeing no further discussion, Sue, will you please call the roll?
Representative Bailey.
Aye.
Representative Barnhart.
Aye.
Representative Benz.
Aye.
Representative
Boone.
Aye.
Representative Jensen.
Aye.
Vice Chair Smith.
Aye.
Vice Chair Gillian.
Aye.
Chair Cannon.
Aye. The motion carries. Thank you, Jimmy. This is a good candidate for the consent calendar. Do we need a motion on that, or do we just put it on the consent calendar?
Unless you get an objection, you can do it.
Is there any objection to placing this bill on the consent calendar? Seeing none. So moved. With that, let's move on to House Bill 3369, if I have that right. So opening a public hearing on House Bill 3369. And members, the purpose in hearing this bill is to draw the committee's attention back to some of the water needs facing our state. And we've heard testimony on that. It's arisen in the context of a number of bills that we've looked at. There are a lot of folks in this building who have done yeoman's work on this issue, this session, on a number of bills. This bill, members, could be a vehicle for the work that our one-time subcommittee of Representative Jensen and Smith have convened and the work that they continue to do. And I want to begin this hearing by asking them to address, in whatever fashion they prefer, to bring us up to date on some of the work that they have been doing with stakeholders, then have Katie Fast and John DeVoe to testify generally, I hope, to the principles that and ideas that Representatives Smith and Jensen set out. And I think those principles are consistent with the intent of the bill before us, 3063. I would note that, you know, we're obviously at it's not 3063, 3369. 3369 is a bill that would authorize lottery-backed grants to the tune of $50 million. It's not my expectation that it will be possible to do that in this climate. But I'm hoping that the creative and spirited work that Representatives Jensen and Smith have done over these last couple of months will allow us to do something in the spirit of 3369. So, gentlemen, will you bring us up to date on your work, and then we'll hear from a couple of the stakeholders who have been involved.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll give a very short note of introduction, then turn it over to Senator Jensen, and then I'll give some substance after that.
You will introduce yourself for the record.
That's part of my introduction.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jefferson Smith, House District 47. Appreciate the objectives of 3369 and the chair's invitation to discuss our work on water generally. Some of the testimony here will relate specifically to the Umatilla Basin. We also recognize that we need a statewide focus in our water work and not merely a crisis-by-crisis approach. So we'll talk about the statewide efforts and with relationship to the intent of House Bill 3369, and I'll turn it over to Representative Jensen, who has been offering senior leadership, who will give the first meaningful piece of our testimony.
I think that means you're up, Representative Jensen. I think he's deferring.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Bob Jensen, Representative Bob Jensen. I serve for House District 58, which constitutes most of Umatilla County and a very, very small sliver of Union County, which interestingly has no Homo sapien constituents. However, it has some of the finest elk hunting in the state of Oregon. So I am pleased to represent an area with so much potential for Oregon sportsmen. Chair Cannon, I would like to thank you for the confidence that you gave to Representative Smith and myself a couple of weeks ago when you assigned us to this committee, and also perhaps complain a little about the difficulty of the, how you made our life very difficult. That was after we'd kind of done some of our preliminary work, a subcommittee of two, which you created in order to solve a lot of problems, presented for Representative Smith and myself another unique problem, and that was we could not meet on the elevator and talk about water, fish, or anything of natural resources on the way up to the penthouses on the fourth floor of the house wings. The subcommittee was disbanded in order to allow us to be able to carry on conversations without having to post hearings of those conversations. The issue that you brought us, the subcommittee together and Representative Smith and I together on, was the issue of bringing additional water to the Umatilla Basin farmers without harming the Umatilla or the Columbia River fish runs. Fortunately for us, and you'll excuse me, colleagues, but I do feel a need to give a little historical background on this, which I'll point out at the end of my testimony why I've done this. Fortunately for us, a lot of groundwork had been done in this area. It goes back over 30 years where the tribes and the farmers in the Umatilla Basin went through a couple of different phases of solving some of the water problems that they had. I've said talked before the committee before about the success of those early efforts on their part. One of the major successes of those early efforts was the restoration of legitimate fishery salmon runs in the Umatilla River, a river where the Chinook salmon had been extinct. That's underlined extinct for 75 years. There currently is, and you'll be able to go out there this spring and, after paying all the appropriate fees and paying the sheriff as you pass through the county line to, have the privilege of being in Umatilla County, you'll be able to fish in the Umatilla River, for salmon, and with expert guides you would be able to hopefully catch a fish. The work is an outstanding and I think remarkable effort that the local folks did there to restore these runs. As far as I know, this is the only place where the extinct species of salmon in the Northwest has been restored, which gives us a reason to have a little bit of encouragement, enthusiasm sometimes about what we're doing. After after this, and as the farmers and tribes continued to work together, they encountered a groundwater problem in the basin. And with that groundwater problem, they formed a coalition and have been working on the solution to that groundwater problem, as well as a broader solution to the use of the natural resource water for purposes of irrigation and improving fisheries in the Umatilla Basin area and in the Umatilla River. Governor Kulongowski, then, in this last interim, formed a group, and they came up with a project that he named H2O, Headwaters to the Ocean. The advisor group, which consisted of stakeholders from every interested area, met and were putting together a plan for forming a statewide policy on water development, water storage, water conservation in Oregon. For reasons, a variety of reasons, they kind of backed off of that, even though they'd kind of reached a point where they were happy or in somewhat agreement as to what should take place and how it should be run. A major part of the problem and reason for their backing off of it a little bit was a recession slash depression that has taken place in the state of Oregon as well as across the nation. And the fear was that with the depression that we're in, this might have been a little bit too big a project to undertake. Now, as I've said in a number of places on this before, I wasn't real pleased with the choice to back away from that position, from Headwaters to the Ocean, or some position to come up with a policy for the state of Oregon to effectively manage this critical natural resource that we have, water. Partially, I was unhappy with that because I've served in the legislature now for this is my seventh session. And during these six sessions, I've gone through one recession, now one depression, and the rest of the time in a period of unprecedented prosperity. The 90s in Oregon were just the really golden years, if you wish, gold in capital letters on that. We had never really enjoyed the prosperity that we were enjoying, at least in the valley and this type of thing. Some of us in eastern Oregon and the rural areas suffered a little from this, but the state as a whole, really benefited from it. Since I come from an area that we've already identified as having some needs as far as water, for my first time that I came to the legislature, I dedicated myself to the issue of water. Not something that I come to by naturally. By profession, I'm a sociologist. That's my educational background, my professional background. And it's a kind of a quantum leap from sociology to water. However, That's my water is my constituents' need. And the more that I became familiar with it, the more I became aware that it's not just my constituents' needs, it's your constituents' needs. It doesn't matter if it rains 360 days a year in your area, you still have a water problem. Or if you, as I have in my area, where some areas, some parts of my district, we maybe get 8 inches of rain a year. And we have a water problem. And the problem is getting worse. Now, if during the 90s, when I was a fledgling in this body, we couldn't do anything about the water issues, if during this period of great prosperity we couldn't do anything about it, if following a gentleman, Chuck Norris, who was, I think, very well known by Representative Bentz and one that was considered to be Mr. Water in the state of Oregon, couldn't get anything done about it, I concluded that during prosperity you can't do anything about these kind of issues and problems. Therefore, since we've gone into a depression, it must be during times of depression that we can effectively do something. Thus my reason for getting on this kind of crippled old pony and trying to, you know, ride it through the race to the end. Now, the project, the aquifer storage project and recharge ASR project in the Umatilla Basin actually goes back, 30 years and has, up until a very recent time, operated solely with the energy and finances of the people in the basin. The farmers and the engineers and scientists there have literally put hundreds of thousands of dollars into study, into on-the-ground projects to make this basin work, to make the idea of aquifer recharge work. The problem appeared before us in the 07 session with the OASIS project that was brought forward by Senator Nelson and caused a great deal of controversy and concern. And it drew out of that inner special session the Senate Bill 1069, which is kind of a watered, dried down, not a watered down, dried down bill. Senate Bill 1069 would have, or didn't would have, did authorize $1.5 million of funding, for studies, feasibility studies. 750,000 of those feasibility studies were, kind of dedicated to the Umatilla Basin, and then some of the rest of it was dedicated to the entire rest of the state. And some of you will recall where some of this money was at when you go back to the beginning of this session, and we were doing the rebalance budget, and there was some money left in the department that was, quote, swept in, and we fought with the co-chairs, and they graciously restored two-thirds of that to continue this research in other parts of the state. At any rate, the bill 1069, Senate Bill 1069, also authorized $2.5 million in lottery bonds to pay for the initial construction on the Umatilla River's ASR, and for field testing of potential in the rest of the basin, Umatilla Basin, in the area to see whether an expansion of the project would be warranted. The current plans carried to its kind of completion would be probably for an expenditure of in the neighborhood of $40 or $42 million to fully develop the aquifer recharge in that Umatilla Basin. And with this, then, as the background, we've tried to take the Umatilla Basin project, my intention has been to take the Umatilla Basin project and the governor's H2O program and put it together in some ways so that, in fact, we can develop a statewide planning program in addition to continuation of this project in the Umatilla Basin. The purposes of the continuation, yes, admittedly, it's self-serving for my district. I understand and will be very quick to admit that. However, the groundwork has been done. The success has been documented. And if that success continues through to the completion of this program, and there's no reason that we have from the scientists to date to indicate that it won't, it will provide an excellent framework and model for potentially similar types of things to be done around the state where you have, again, equal need for water. The problem, of course, is always money. Much to my surprise, when we got involved in the Ways and Means hearing on the Water Resource Department's budget, I find that there's an Article 11I of the Oregon Constitution, not statute, of the Constitution, which authorizes the Water Resource Department to issue bonds for the purposes of water development around the state. So at least some authority is there. Additionally, there's the other thing, I think some incredible potential as far as stimulus money out there. But I would submit to you that without a statewide plan, without a statewide plan for how we're going to develop our water, what we're going to do, the chances of getting the stimulus money is not real good. With a good statewide plan, the chances of getting the stimulus money, I think, improve dramatically. In addition to loan bonding, Article 11I bonding for money for projects, we would also look for the possibility of using some of this loan for authorized loans or grants to other or to any district around the state for purposes of meeting their needs. And with this, I am proposing that we would have probably lottery bonds in the neighborhood of about $10 million for that as seed money for those projects. The basic skeletal proposal that we want to develop and bring to this committee is to maintain the $2.5 million in the governor's recommended budget for the Umatilla Basin aquifer recharge program. We want to revive existing water development loan fund under the Water Resources Department, Article 11I. Want to create a water resource grant fund under the Water Resources Department. We'd like to have, promote a $100 million bond ceiling for the Water Resources Department for water resources development and conservation projects across the state. And we'd want to direct the Water Resources Department to sell bonds to finance, that will be accomplished via the bill that we have if it's successful, sell bonds to finance the and complete the early and first phase of the Umatilla Basin project, and we want to require certain environmental impact standards for recipients of the Water Resource Department loans or grants, and we would propose modeling some of those standards on the elements of the collaborative work that has taken place in the Umatilla Basin, and we'd like to further direct the Water Resource Department to promote the loan fund to other public entities in other basins around the state, and not to include just the agricultural community in the use of that resource. And with that, I've taken longer than perhaps Representative Smith wanted me to, and so I'll let him proceed.
Thank you, Representative Jensen. Members of the committee, Mr. Chair. I said my name for the record. First, I wanted to, for the record, I want to say I think he meant that the crippled old pony was the issue, not me. Crippled maybe. I want to say thanks to a bunch of people as we start, just because we have relatively few people testifying, many people who have done more work on this, certainly, than I have. Representative Jensen has done a huge amount of work. Also want to thank the chair, Water Resources Department, Bob Levy, the tribes, Agricultural Community Water Watch, Mike Carey, the governor's office, etc. Three groups in addition to that, the H2O Advisory Council that Representative Jensen mentioned, Umatilla Basin Coalition, which has done impressive coalition building, setting a potential example for the state, and also want to plug again the Water Resource Department, who is also going through their budget hearings right now before Representative Jensen's subcommittee, and I think it's really important that we figure out the funding piece of how to manage our water resources as at least as part of this, at least as related to this. I also want to give a thanks that wasn't in the prepared words to my aide, Quinn Riley, who it is not exaggeration, has not hyperbolic to say he's worked around the clock. I believe he spent three nights in my office. If you've seen the couches that we are given, you know, despite the Oregonian, you know, critique of the office renovation, the couches are relatively humbly small, and he is not an enormous man, but bigger than the couches. And want to say thanks to, you know, he was here last night till midnight and in this morning before 7. The Representative Jensen already mentioned this began with House Bill 2406. We recognized, I think, relatively early that the challenge was broader and deeper than that. Umatilla Electric Cooperative, who brought forward that bill, has said that if this moves forth, they do not intend to push another OASIS bill. Another note of background, the economic conversation right now as it regards stimulus has been an exercise manifestation of Keynesian economics, right? Put a dollar into the economy and it multiplies to $1.7 or $2.2. And I think the agreement that several of us came to was that if you invest a dollar into turning fallow ground to green ground, the multiplier is much bigger than $1.7 or $2.2. That could be one of the bigger economic development exercises that we do to focus on the Umatilla Basin water challenges and the statewide water challenges beyond that. Agricultural jobs are not easily outsourced, and the ASR project specifically as a model is being designed to return water to streams in addition to irrigation. Very importantly, and let me take a very brief pause here, whatever we do must be win-win-win, and we've tried to be consistent in saying win-win and win. Good for fish and the environment, good for irrigation and agricultural, and agriculture, good for, as well, fiscal responsibility for the state in the immediate and long term. As Representative Jensen mentioned, there has been, for a long time, Oregon has lacked a funding mechanism and sufficient resources for water resources planning. My own junior political analysis of that, perhaps oversimplified, is that urban Democrats have under-prioritized water resources and rural Republicans have been under-comfortable with paying fees for the planning of them. The
Article 11I had challenges in the 80s and 90s in part because there was discomfort with the degree of the spread. The SELP program that Representative Bailey has been working with and others, the Small Energy Loan Program through the Department of Energy, has a 1.5% spread on the loans that it gives. The spread on Article 11I was reduced in the 80s and 90s due to stakeholder critiques. The next critique came was that the agency didn't have enough funds to administer the program. The next critique came that the program was failing. The next critique came that the general fund had to be used to bail out the program. So for us to use, and I say this on the record to be very clear so that we're being fully candid about the vehicles we're using, I believe that Article 11I is the perfect, is an ideal vehicle, and that to do it, we have to be cognizant that we don't that we provide the resources necessary to administer it, that the expertise is housed within the Water Resource Department to administer the program, including the financing of it. We also recognize that this has to be viewed in the context of a statewide water plan, that not only policy but also politically, it's hard to address the Umatilla Basin challenge without addressing the larger state challenge. I won't go through the skeleton proposal that Representative Jensen did, which means I am almost done. Let me just identify a few to-be-answered questions. One is we are working on environmental impact criteria as both a policy and political matter. We must make sure that where we spend public dollars or loan public dollars on development projects, that we are environmentally sensitive and help double down on Oregon's brand as a global leader in that sector. In Umatilla, we've had the chance to preview the kind of water shortages that experts tell us is coming to other areas of the state and other areas of the West and the country. When applicants approach the Water Resources Loan Fund or Grant Fund, they will have to meet certain environmental impact criteria to qualify for funds. We're working with concerned citizens, watchdog groups, the tribes, and the agricultural community to protect our public resources while we facilitate economic development. We're drafting language this week and hope to have a proposal ready by the end of this week. The states had a responsibility, has a responsibility when it spends dollars to do so in the public interest. Second question, to be answered question, or to be continued to answered question, is regards the additional revenues that may be required to do statewide water planning and ongoing maintenance for this water project, other water projects, and to make sure that if we create what could be a flywheel of support for water development projects, that this is not just something that benefits the Umatilla Basin, but something that can benefit other water projects, including those projects that might not have as obvious economic development advantages in the short term. We think this is both a political and a policy necessity. To be clear about this and take a half a pause, we've got to show that this is a great deal for the state. There will be many good deals that our state sets aside given our fiscal shortfalls. So we have to show how this is a great deal for the state. Luckily, we have various legitimate criteria for doing this, from public investments in baseball stadiums and sports stadiums to the spread on SELP loans. And so we need to be looking at that to make sure that the numbers work out and that we can move ahead of the line in the Ways and Means process as one of the best investments that the state can make this year. Let me just say beyond that, I should say something else on the record. We also want to make sure that there is as much certainty as we can provide to the stakeholders in the Umatilla Basin that we'll be moving forward to completion on this project. And we'll have to be very careful in not doing so in a way that ties our hands if big things change, but also that justifies the kind of investment up front that's going to be necessary to reap the economic advantages that we see from doing this. So I will cut it shorter there. This, to be clear, this may take two or three bills. There are a couple different bill vehicles that could be used. There are two representatives here who both offered to use priority bills if need be. We're going to be moving as fast as possible, more quickly than we would under other circumstances, but I think just about everybody we've talked to has said two things. One, geez, I don't see how we can get done. And second, geez, I can't imagine how we would want not to get done and not try to complete something meaningful this session. Time is short. We're working hard to get much done. We won't get it all done this session. We will get as far as we can. It may end up taking two or three different bills in a package, and we appreciate the time to keep the committee updated.
Thank you very much. And your work on this, not just your legislative aid, but both of your personal work on this has really been extraordinary and greater even than I could have imagined when I asked you to go off and work on this project. The number of meetings that you've had individually and jointly is really impressive, and it's great to hear so much still enthusiasm for the project. I think I can characterize it that way. We are still moving forward. You understand that the kind of timing, the deadlines that we're up against, and I very much hope that we'll have something to LC, whether it's an amendment to this bill or whether it's a priority bill that we can get very quickly out, probably the former, in order to keep up with the deadlines that have been imposed on us by leadership. So we're working. Representative Smith.
For that timeline, you had mentioned, I believe, that a potential work session next Thursday might work in terms of your overall and the committee's overall schedule. Is that a deadline that we should be thinking about as a work group and as a committee and as the stakeholders that are here in the room, or is there a different timeline that we should be thinking about in terms of having that first work session and having something? I mean, I think we can have something drafted by then. I certainly hope so, and I apologize, Quinn, who probably just fainted.
Well, to keep everybody on the same page, our deadline is for actually moving bills is the 27th. Is that right?
28.
So we have, committee, we have 6 possible committee meetings at which we could move a bill. The last possible is April 28th. So it needs to be posted by April 17th, and it needs to move by April 28th. I think the sooner we get those amendments in the works, the more likely we are to have time to refine them before we move the bill along. But really do appreciate, I think in the interest of time, I'm going to suggest that we'll take our follow-up offline. And again, thank you so much for the work. I'll ask Katie Fast and John DeVoe to come up with brief commentary. We still do have a resolution that I want to get to before 5 o'clock. I know Representative Boone does as well. So
I'll be brief.
Take that up. Yeah.
Chair Cannon, members of the committee, for the record, Katie Fast with the Oregon Farm Bureau. House Bill 3369 was requested by an interest from the municipal and agricultural sectors. As you all are aware, Oregon's demand for a growing population and agriculture's need to meet increased food demands in the future creates a large demand on water. At this time, also on the overlay, is we have critical water shortages. You've heard about issues in the Umatilla, but we also have issues here in the Willamette Valley in southern Oregon and Klamath Falls, central Oregon statewide. And Oregon will and can meet these demands through conservation, reuse, and storage projects. 3369, the framework, builds on 1069, which this body passed in February session that funded feasibility studies for conservation, reuse, and storage projects throughout the state. And it also is a concept that came out of discussions, while not part of the formal budget, but came out of discussions in the governor's H2O process. And I think groups' frustration or disappointment that a bill did not was not introduced through the governor's office introduced this as a starting point and a discussion for water projects in the state. With that being said, I think we are all very excited about the odd couple or the dynamic duo, whichever pair you want to use for your water subcommittee, and have enjoyed working with the two as a project is finalized. I think there are still, some details that, are awaiting for another follow-up meeting with the different stakeholders. I do want to make a comment about
the water development fund in the Constitution. That was looked at with stakeholder groups and the department during the interim. There are some constraints to that fund. It is dedicated that at least 50% would go to agriculture. So for my interest, not a bad thing. Additionally, there is a constraint that for municipal projects, it is limited to cities with 30,000 population or less. So in the coalition and groups that I look at, some of these projects, especially when we're looking at the Willamette Valley or other areas, might be multiple use. And it may put some potential constraints on some of those projects moving forward. But it is a fund that's been used in the past, maybe incorrectly, and I think it's one that could be built upon depending where this body wants to go. With that, you know, I think I'll keep my questions short, and maybe I can even give John's comments for the committee as well.
That would be interesting. Enjoy that. John.
Chair Cannon, members of the committee, my name is John DeVoe. I'm executive director of Water Watch. I think Katie probably could give my comments today because I'm here to salute Representative Smith and Jensen for their efforts to date. Certainly, we can't support this bill as written, but we salute what they've done. We salute the process. And we hope that there's time to put together a result that is truly a win-win-win for all interests. You know, Water Watch has worked for over two decades in the Umatilla Basin, and we are certainly willing to devote the time and resources to achieve an outcome for the Umatilla that protects the health of the Columbia, its fish runs, and helps restore the Umatilla River and its fish runs as well. And I'd be remiss if I didn't salute the tribes for their tremendous effort over the years in restoring those fish runs, but also in this process. I think they've been a huge helpful factor. You know, we recognize and salute the efforts of those in the Umatilla Basin who are efficient with water, who manage water carefully through measurement and other techniques. And we believe that many of the efficiency and management techniques used in the Umatilla Basin would be appropriate for other regions in the state and are certainly important elements of securing Oregon's water future. So we recognize the wisdom of trying to leverage what's being done in the Umatilla for the rest of the state, and we endorse that effort. I do want to mention that the H2O experience that we went through in the interim, and I served on that advisory committee along with Katie, what we talked about there was always in terms of a package. And what we're going to need to do in the short time that remains is make sure that we come up with the rest of the elements of a package here that can meet the needs of all interests. So we look forward to working with the folks who are involved with this effort on achieving the elements of the package so we can address all of the issues that are out there and make sure that what we create is sound for the entire state as we move forward. Again, I want to thank both representatives for their efforts, and we look forward to working with you to try and achieve a satisfactory result for everybody. Thank you.
Thank you, John. And some elements of those package may be in the form of bills that this committee may take up as they come over, if they come over from the Senate. And I think those conversations will be ongoing. And I want to express, I mean, it is my intent to get a bill out of this committee, and that bill is unlikely to be perfect. It's unlikely to be done, especially given the timing. It's likely to have a long path. You know, if we move along the lines of the framework that Representatives Jensen and Smith have mentioned, it will include subsequence to revenue and to ways and means. And we'll have the opportunity to see how it fits with other pieces of the puzzle, including funding for this department, which sit on this budget subcommittee. And it's frightening what they're contemplating in the way of cuts, and those are cuts that concern, I know, all the stakeholders who are represented here. So there are a lot of pieces to this, and this is just one of them, but it is one that I do intend to try to move along here in the next couple of weeks, and then you know that there will be, you know, at least three members of this committee who will remain pretty deeply engaged in this issue as it works its way through. And, you know, it goes to our revenue committee. We'll have several other members of this committee over there also putting their heads around it with an eye in particular towards revenue impacts. But appreciate both of your testimony on the bill and continued good faith work with Representatives Smith and Jensen. Thanks.
Thank you.
Let's close the public hearing on House Bill 3369. Thank you. And open a public hearing on HCR 9. And Representative Boone.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee, for the record, Deborah Boone, House District 32, the beautiful upper left coast. And I bring to you today House Concurrent Resolution 9, which honors a constituent of mine and friend of many in this building and around the state, Dr. Bob Bacon. Dr. Bacon was a quintessential coastal advocate, and he didn't start out that way. He might have liked to go to the beach, but he was a anatomy professor at U of O Medical School, OHSU. And when he retired, he was known, he had been awarded seven times some great award for instructors, professors up there. And he's the kind of professor that you never forgot. And I used to run into him occasionally at Laurel's Wine Shop in Cannon Beach, where he held court in the chair. And he presided over the tasting activities in the afternoon and would put his approval or not on any particular wine she had open, most particularly the wine she made herself. And in closing, I know we're time constrained here today, but in closing, I would be remiss if I didn't mention that he was instrumental in passing the Oregon Beach Bill and giving access to our beautiful coastline to all Oregonians. And he passed away peacefully at the Wheeler Clinic and at the age of 90, and had a good long life. And one of his final wishes was, should we implement marine reserves in our state, that one be named for him. He wanted a particular site, which we couldn't promise, but when someone you respect and love asks for something like that, you try to do your very best. So you may see me before you again at some time in the near future. And in the meantime, I hope you'll support this. This bill should pass through easily, and you will be honoring a great person, great Oregonian. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Boone. Director Wood, will you add your commentary as well?
Thank you, Chair Cannon, members of the committee. I'm Tim Wood, the director of the Oregon Parks and Recreation Department, and I'm honored to add my able words of support for this resolution. All of us here today are lucky that Bob Bacon crossed our path, whether we were fortunate enough to have known him personally or, like me, are the beneficiaries of his talent, his considerable intellect, and most of all, his passion for our oceans and ocean shore. We are all lucky indeed. To me, an Oregonian who came here 12 years ago from Ohio, Dr. Bacon represents something about Oregon that we outsiders discover early in our experience here. It's the discovery that this state shares people's thinking. It makes leaders out of ordinary citizens. Look at any given year in Oregon's past, and you'll see name after name after name of public figures and private individuals who have all been motivated by the simple concept of citizenship. People like Governor Oswald West, Oregon's first park superintendent, Sam Boardman, Governors Tom McCall and Bob Strom, Robert Sawyer of Bend, and the man we honor today, Dr. Bob Bacon. These are all people who had a vision of what our state should look like and how it should be. There is something uniquely Oregon about the force of individual determination meeting up with a sense of collective good. The idea that one individual can make a difference, can marshal support among the many for a single idea or principle, can persist and pursue a vision no matter how difficult and even dangerous, to me, that's what sets Oregonians apart from smart and dedicated people from other places around this world. When we remember Dr. Bacon, we can and will cite his connection to state parks, to the ocean shores, and of course to the Beach Bill. What started as a small conflict between beach visitors and a motel manager a conflict that Dr. Bacon inserted himself into, eventually became the landmark public policy we are all so proud of today. Dr. Bacon helped revive a dying piece of legislation in 1967 and placed it squarely in the public eye. He helped form the Citizens to Save Oregon Beaches and became its president. He worked tirelessly to pass this bill and later to make it better. Public ownership of the beaches has been codified into law because of people like Bob Bacon. We'll remember him as a professor, as a zoologist, a father, husband, and friend. I didn't have the honor of knowing Dr. Bacon, but let the record reflect that Oregonians will remember him for all those things and just one more. Dr. Bacon was a citizen, and to me, that says the best. And I would also like to thank Representative Boone and the colleagues who supported this resolution on the House side and those on the Senate side who have passed a similar resolution. Thank you.
Thank you.
I just have to add, it was Senator Johnson pointed out, too, that the original dust-up also occurred in our district in Cannon Beach.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And with that, I'll close the public hearing on HCR 9 and open a work session on HCR 9 and accept a motion.
Mr. Chair, I move that HCR 9 be moved to the floor.
Be adopted.
Be adopted. That's all I have to say. Be adopted.
Wow. That's easy. Representative Smith moves that HCR 9 be adopted. Who knew? Is there any further discussion? Representative Smith?
Two things. First, wanted to thank you, Representative Boone, for bringing this forward. And second, with regard to the time, the last honorific resolution we did and the comment I had on the record that time, it occurs to me we maybe should have, maybe there exists already, but some sort of legislative Oregon Hall of Fame. And so that if you get, you know, the vote, it's not only goes into a book, you know, like one little, we pass something someday, but, you know, there's, you get like a picture, you know, and so anyway, it's just an idea. That's all I'd say.
Any further discussion? Seeing none, will the clerk call the roll?
Representative Bailey?
Aye.
Representative Barnhart?
Aye.
Representative Benson?
Aye.
Representative Booth?
Aye.
Representative Jensen?
Aye.
Vice Chair Smith?
Aye.
Vice Chair Gillen?
Aye.
Chair Cannon?
Aye. Motion carries, and Representative Boone, I presume you'd be willing to carry
thank
this
you.
To the floor.
Happy to, thank
Very
you.
Very good. With that, I thank you, committee members. Please note, we're out of here again before 5 o'clock, despite these full agendas. Thank you for that. And April 16th, you should have received notice. We are scheduled to have an evening hearing on that night, 6 to 8 p.m. Thank you, members. With that, I'll close House Committee on Environment and Water.